Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Okay, I'm very excited to be talking to John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire, who's also created a fantastic freedom journal to help people reach their goals in 100 days. But one of the coolest things about John is that he knows firsthand more stories of failure than anybody I know. John, you've interviewed like hundreds, maybe 1,000 people who tell you their stories of failure, but they always have like a comeback story. So tell me, what's the difference between people who overcome failure and those who just succumb to failure?
That's a great question, Douglas. And I'm now actually at episode 1400 of Entrepreneur on Fire. So I haven't changed the format in all 1,400 episodes, and you're so right about that question that I ask every single episode. So now over 1,400 times, I've asked my guests point blank, you included, Douglas, I said, what is your worst entrepreneurial moment ever? And I just make them tell that story. And some people, Douglas, they try to get vague. They try to just be like, oh yeah, like I had a couple bad, I'm like, I don't want a couple bad years. Right. I want the moment in time. Like, was it raining out? Did you cry? Like what happened? And I make them tell that story because I think it's so important to see that successful entrepreneurs have been massive failures, have just fallen on their face, have just completely bombed in every way, shape, and form. But the one thing that they did do was they didn't stop. They did not stop. They just kept on persevering through those tough times, through those struggles, through those obstacles. And that's actually one thing that I see to kind of really answer your question directly is successful entrepreneurs, they're not even actually always looking for the yes, or they're not always looking for the success. A lot of them are looking for the no. And what I mean by that is they know absolutely that they're going to get 9 no's to get to 1 yes. So when they get a no, they're like, okay, sweet, thanks, bye. And the person's like, well, why is that person so happy that they just said no? Well, because you're one of the 9 no's that I have to experience if I'm going to get to a yes. So thank you for being one of those. And you just realize that you're not going to hit a home run every time. You know, when a baseball player gets 3 hits and 7 strikeouts out of 10 at bats, they're an all-star. Okay. They're an all-star. They might even go to the Hall of Fame with those numbers. That's insanity. And that's the life of an entrepreneur. You only need a couple hits out of every dozen or so swings you take to be a success in life. And entrepreneurs who have achieved success, they know that.
So I want to turn that, look at that also from an investment standpoint, because the same principle applies. People are trying and they fail and they fail and they fail. But the people that, you know, get themselves back up, and when in 2009, when the stock market was crashing and, you know, really hitting the bottom, someone asked Warren Buffett, because they were kind of a little bit snarky. They said, so Mr. Buffett, how does it feel to have just lost 40% of the wealth you've accumulated over your whole life? And Buffett said, he goes, well, it actually feels very much like the previous 3 times that I lost 40% of my net worth. But how do you get that attitude? And again, I want you to draw from, you know, you've spoken to people who really failed and they turn themselves around. And, you know, that's what we tell investors. You got to stick with it, but it's not easy.
Well, number one, it probably helps when you lose 40% of your net worth and you're still a multi-billionaire. Like that probably helps a little bit.
Right.
But I mean, this is the thing is that how I finish every one of those stories that my guests share when it comes to their worst entrepreneurial moment, I then say, okay, now let's dive into the lessons learned. Let's talk about what you learned from that. And then they kind of perk up a little bit because, of course, it's tough to talk about the worst moments because, you know, I'm physically bringing them there. Like, I'm just like just dragging them through that mud all over again. And I'll get a lot of them that will start off by saying, John, like, I'm kind of getting shivers and chills right now because, you know, this really gives me anxiety to think about because it was such a tough, sad, you know, incredibly difficult time in my life. But then when we get to like, what were the lessons learned? You know, they perk up and they just have these incredible lessons learned. And that's where, you know, I think Warren Buffett, you know, when he has, you know, has lost it and then gained it back again, all those times, like every time he's learned an incredibly valuable lesson. And I'm sure one of them was, like, don't panic. Like, don't just when you're down 40%, it doesn't mean you sell everything. No, maybe you double down in some of those areas where you know that the company is still strong and they will be coming back, but the general market is just panicking. And of course, you probably know these quotes better than I do, but you know, like Warren Buffett loves saying, you know, he likes to be greedy when other people are panicking, and he is more panicking when people are greedy. Like, he's really trying to go against that tide. So what are you as an entrepreneur learning from those tough times, and how are you going to apply it to that next time you face that struggle, that obstacle, that challenge? And that's the mark of a long-term successful entrepreneur.
Right. I think if you're a lifetime learner, that's important. And the critical thing really is also to start young. I remember when I started on Wall Street, I was actually partners with my mother. My mother was a vice president, and I was like this young rookie, and I was 20-something years old. And I thought, I'm really good at math. And I started trading options for myself because it's like all mathematical. And I made money. Like in the first week, I made a couple of $1,000. And I thought I was all smart. And needless to say, of course, the next week, I just got crushed and lost that and way more. And my mother started laughing at me. And you know, like, your mother shouldn't laugh at you. And I said, why are you laughing? She goes, it's a good thing you lost the money now so that when one day I leave you an inheritance, you don't lose all of it then. So I learned a lesson. And I think from what you're telling me, just correct me if I'm wrong, the takeaway from this question is people who deal with failure and come around to succeed are the people who try to learn the life lesson and just move on.
100%. 100%.
All right, so let's go to the next question. We're talking with John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire, a fantastic podcast, one that I've not only listened to, I can't say all 1,400 episodes, but many, many episodes, and I've had the honor of being on it. And my co-author, Susan Polgar, was also a guest. And you know, she's the chess grandmaster and has said exactly what you've said to me, but she just uses a chess metaphor, which is,
of course,
you know, you got to go back and do a post-mortem and look at your games. One of the other issues, which I think is also very parallel between entrepreneurs and investors, is there's a lot of stress involved, and especially when you're dealing with a couple. And a lot of the people that you talk to, and yourself included, work at home, and they're very, you know, they're related, they're very close to their house. And we often praise that and say, oh yeah, it's great, you're with your spouse, you're with your kids, but you're also in very tight quarters, and the stress can be huge. And as a financial advisor, I often work with couples, and I see the stress. You know, they come into my office, and they don't beat each other up, but you know, they're definitely dealing with that. In the 1,400 conversations you've had, what do you find is a trait that makes people able to deal with that success without you know, killing each other?
Well, one of the things that really helps make a successful partnership, so to speak, both in business and in the home, is that you have strengths where your other partner has some weaknesses, and then vice versa, that your partner has those strengths where you have weaknesses. And for me, I've just found over and over again, like, there's just certain things that I am really good at, and I want to spend my time amplifying that strength and those things that I'm good at, because nobody wants people that are okay at something. Like, why would I spend a ton of time at stuff that I'm crappy at to become okay at it? Because even if I become okay at it, it's still been a waste of time, because this world doesn't want okay, it wants great. And so for me, I'm able to spend my time at what I'm really good at to amplify that. And I'm able to have my partner step up, you know, at what she's really good at and focus on that and amplify her strengths. Likewise, our weaknesses are offset by that. So really making sure that you are being strategic about that, that you don't just have a business where it's just the two of you and you're both Uber type A, you're both totally take charge, you both totally hate details and all that stuff. Like, then you're setting yourself up for failure unless you're willing right off the bat to bring in somebody on a team. Maybe you're going to hire, you know, like a full-time CPA, or hire, you know, a full-time financial advisor that's going to be like there with you, making sure you're doing all those right things to run a well-rounded business. And plus, I think a really important thing, Douglas, that people have to realize is, you know, there has to be an on-off switch. Like, if you are working with a partner and you're friends with them, or it happens to be your significant other, that can't be lost. Like, there has to be a time where if it's your buddy, you're shutting things down at a certain time, you're going out for a beer, and you're keeping that friendship alive. Or if it's your significant other, you know, you're shutting it down, you're sitting down to a nice dinner together, and you're talking about non-business related stuff. Because otherwise, then it just becomes just like one long, endless marathon slog, and you lose what's most important, you know, which is that special person in your life. So those are a couple really key things that I've seen over the 1,400 episodes.
So what if you are not actually partners? What if, I mean, the example that I'll often see a lot is, one of the spouses handles the investment portfolio. The same way one of them might be the entrepreneur, but the other one has, you know, a real job. And, you know, and all of a sudden you're going for a big deal and, you know, you lose $100,000 or you invest in a stock and it goes bad. And then that's when it all, you know, all hell breaks loose because the other person's not even involved in your business. And in most, I don't know, I'm not sure the percentages for you, but certainly a lot of cases, you know, the husband does his thing, the wife does her thing.
Yeah, totally.
And all of a sudden, but they share the common bank account, which can take a, you know, a huge hit. How do they deal with that in order not to, you know, in order to stay married, even if, because, you know, when the money's so volatile?
Yeah, the ones who I've seen who have achieved success, even when they're leading completely separate professional lives, are those that keep the communication going all the time. So leading up to any big move or big acquisition or big risk or whatever it might be, the conversation has been happening in the days, the weeks, the months preceding that. So if it goes great, you know, it's not like out of the blue. And if things go horrible, that's not out of the blue either. So keeping them involved and then you likewise being involved in what they're doing, because it has to be that two-way street. So just always keeping that communication going and cluing them in. I mean, you know, all of us want to sweep our mistakes under the rug and, you know, we want to just shout our successes from the rafters, you know, but we have to realize that if we are going to share our successes, we also have to share our failures and our tough times. And it shouldn't be coming as a surprise. It should be a complete communication that both of you are on board with going forward. Otherwise, you're in for a rocky road.
Yeah, I think that's critical, especially in a family. We'll often talk about budgeting. And it applies to whether you're in business or just managing your own money. The two of you have to sit down together, you know, on a monthly basis, look where you're spending, what you're earning. Because if you're going to have a bad month and you're not going to be able to pay for the groceries, you're going to have to go to your in-laws to borrow some money. Boy, you really want your spouse to know that up front.
Yeah.
That can be scary. So then you sort of go to the question of getting professional help. I'm not talking about now marriage help. I'm just talking about, let's say, in business. And again, I think there's a great parallel between investors and entrepreneurs. You yourself talk a great deal about coaching and getting coaches, but it's expensive for a lot of people. In the same way, I talk to people about going to a financial advisor, and there are costs involved in that too. And in the same way, an entrepreneur says to you, yeah, you know, I'll read a book about it and I'll be okay. Same way people come to me and say, Doug, I'll just buy, you know, no, I'll go trade in a, you know, a discount brokerage firm and I'll be okay. How should a person know when it's good to spend money to build himself up or to save the money for reinvesting in his own business?
You know, I like to say penny wise, pound foolish. I think that is a really true term in pretty much everything that you're doing. I mean, as soon as Entrepreneur on Fire started generating revenue, the first thing I did was say, hey, I got to get my taxes in order because I'm bringing in a lot of money. I'm an entrepreneur. I know I have quarterly taxes that are due here in America. It's one of the things you have to do. And I want to make sure that all my I's are dotted and all my T's are crossed. And this is not my strong suit because like I'm working on producing content for entrepreneurs, for EO Fire, writing emails, doing social media, all this stuff. So I went out and I just found the best gosh darn CPA that I could find. Like I was just like, this person gets entrepreneurs, he gets business. I'm bringing him on the team. That investment, you know, has paid so many dividends, you know, that, you know, if I would have just tried to, you know, just do like TurboTax is something we have in the States here,
sure.
You know, at the end of every year, I would have found that, oh my goodness, like, you know, I haven't been keeping up my business expenses. I've been commingling funds. You know, I haven't been taking out the right deduction. Like the list goes on and it would have been a mess, a nightmare, and would have just so taken me away distraction wise from the business as well. But bringing on a CPA that knew what he was doing and that was able to get my house in order the day, basically, you know, basically the month that I started generating positive revenue, I had my I's dotted and my T's crossed, has saved me so much money. So trying to go the cheap route, trying to be penny wise at first can really bite you big in the end. Just like if you have some disposable income and you want to invest it and you just, you know, again, don't get help for people willing to take the time to understand the situation that you're in, the goals, the aspirations that you have financially, and then you put it all into a stock or whatever it might be that doesn't line up with your risk profile. And the next thing you know, you wake up and that stock's gone down 40%. You're just like, what happened? Well, I mean, was it really worth going, you know, with a discounted brokerage or somebody that doesn't know who you are or what you're looking for? Of course not, because maybe your son or daughter is going to college next year and you have to have a certain amount of money set aside no matter what happens to the market. Like that's critical stuff to know. And you're not going to be able to do it because it's not your strong suit. So give it to somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. John, I like how you're pointing out that as soon as you started making money, you decided, I'm not going to handle my money like a politician. I'm going to get real professionals to handle it for me.
Oh, you have corrupt politicians in Israel, too? I thought it was just America.
Oh, no. I was just using that as a metaphor. I don't really know. Listen, I think the main point is there's really two sides to this. One of them is whether you're an investor or an entrepreneur, you got to figure out what value you add to the equation. What are you good at? And do that. And everything else you should outsource. And, you know, it's funny, even though I'm a financial advisor and people always, they say, oh, what, you're not an accountant? Even though I kind of look like one. I say, no, I don't do taxes, right? I have a bookkeeper and I'm an accountant just like you. And, you know, you have to figure out what value do you bring to the company? What's it worth literally in, you know, how many dollars per hour? And if you can hire someone for less, you should absolutely be doing that. And I think in the end, you'll also just be happier because you do what you like and you're not, you know, and you're not trying to be everything. Because if your goal is to be teaching people and writing content like you do, well, you know, that's what you should be doing. Someone else should be doing everything else, which I think...
Well, I'll give you a real example that just actually happened a couple days ago. You know, my father, he's a great guy, very successful lawyer, and, you know, but he's still kind of from the old school. You know, he's from Maine, like pinch every single penny. And, you know, he's out there mowing the lawns and he was just like, John, like I see you got a pretty big lawn down there in Puerto Rico. Like that must take you a long time. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm like, I have a lawn guy that comes every Friday and he does all of my lawns. And I have a maid that comes and does all of my dishes. Like, I'm not lying. Like I have them do it. He's like, oh, you should really do that yourself. You would save like what? Like 40, 50 bucks a week. And I'm like, are you saying that like my time going out and mowing the lawn for 4 hours to save 40 bucks, but taking 4 hours of my time, not to mention the energy and the bandwidth and all that stuff. I'm like, I made a couple $100,000 last month. Like my time, my hourly time is much higher than $10 per hour, believe me. So I am so much better served doing my thing, producing content, doing podcasts like this.
And he doesn't get it though. He has no idea what you do.
He doesn't get it. He's like, he doesn't get it.
You're spoiled. He just doesn't see.
Yeah, totally. He's like, ah, kids these days. I'm like, all right.
It's not real work what you do, right? Because you don't go to a boss who pays you a weekly paycheck. Hey, John, listen, right. We're out of time here, but tell me in the last few seconds what you're up to and how people can follow you and follow your work.
Well, the thing I'm most passionate about is, you know, I get the question all the time, like, John, what do these entrepreneurs that you interview, now over 1,400, have in common? And the one commonality they all share is they know how to accomplish goals. And so many people that don't find success don't know how to accomplish goals. And so that was kind of my biggest passion project as of late. You know, that's where I'm really pouring all of my current time and energy into. And we've created this amazing hardcover gold embossed journal called the Freedom Journal, which guides you in accomplishing your number one goal in 100 days. We're super passionate about it. We've sold over 14,000 to date. Wow. And it's just been a huge excitement for me to see people actually now crushing their goals. And if you want to check out more about goals, head over to thefreedomjournal.com.
Okay, we'll put a link to that at the show notes of today's show. John Lee Dumas, a real pleasure talking.
Ditto.
Okay, now we're ready for the panel portion of the Money Tree Investment Podcast. Today, we are once again missing Joe Saul Sehi. It appears that he has traveled to Spain and is not interested in talking to us. But in his place again, the wonderful Shannon McClay is joining us. Shannon, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. So glad to be sitting in Joe's seat. I'm getting comfy here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. And actually, I hear the pedals going in on the spinning machines in the financial gym that you've got going in New York.
Yeah, we're working our assets out like crazy up here.
All right. That is a great line. Okay, but we won't go in there too much in depth. Miranda Marquette, where are you?
I am at home in Idaho, enjoying, once again, some great autumn weather. It's nice to live in a place where we have four seasons. So, hurrah.
They have the four seasons in New York also, but that's a separate thing. Linda P. Jones, what's going on with you?
Hey, Doug. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Doing okay here in Israel. What's on your end?
Well, we're having an overcast day today, but hope to get back to some sunshine soon.
Overcast. All right. All right. So I want to go with the most optimistic of the three of you to start the question. As you know, talking to John Lee Dumas is like talking to someone who is as optimistic as can be, which is kind of fun. But one of the things I think that I'm, well, not to be cynical, but do you think the concept of always learning from failure. You know, we say it all the time, and you want to say it to clients when their portfolio goes down. Well, what can we learn from this? But is this being overly optimistic? So, optimistic Miranda, how do you deal with investment failures?
Luckily, I don't have to worry about it because I index.
Oh, I thought because you always win. My stocks only go up.
All you do is win.
No, we all make mistakes. And I think the key is getting over it and moving forward. It can be difficult to get over it and move forward, especially if you've lost a lot of money. But you do need to kind of move forward, learn from it, and then move on. You know, what did I do wrong here? One of the things that I remember doing from an investment challenge a couple years ago was I was putting together a dividend portfolio as part of this challenge, and I had AT&T in there as a dividend-paying stock. And after a couple of months, AT&T was doing not as well as I thought it should have been doing. And so I sold it and replaced it with something else. Later in the year, they started doing better. And then the dividends went up. And so then I regretted it because instead of it pretty much, that mistake pretty much took me out of the top 10 of our investing challenge. And it was kind of a bummer. But I learned from that instead of changing things around because you don't think it's doing as well as you think it should be doing at the moment, you need to look at the fundamentals, and the fundamentals hadn't really changed. And I sold it anyway. And so that's kind of a mistake that luckily didn't have a huge impact on me, but it was a mistake that didn't have a huge impact on me, but it was something that I kind of remembered going forward. And when you do make an investing mistake, you need to learn from it and do better next time.
All right. And Shannon, are you a learn from mistake kind of person, or do you just, you know, boil in your mistakes?
Yeah. See, I'm one of those painfully optimistic people too. And, you know, and I've read somewhere, cause I am an entrepreneur. It's like, I think you have to be an entrepreneur. You have to believe that something's going to work. Otherwise you'd never take the risk, but nothing we do financially can't be undone. It's just a matter of how much work that we have to put into it. But any financial mistakes we have, and I've seen this over the last 3 years working with people, they can always be undone. So if you have a poor investment portfolio, you made a mistake or whatever, you lost money, well, you just make it back. And sometimes you're not able to make it back in the markets, but you work hard, you do something else to make it back. But I've seen it happen all the time. We all stumble, but it can be undone. It's just a matter of how much time and energy and effort it'll take to undo it, but it can be undone.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Linda? Do you feel that people can recover from their mistakes?
I definitely do, and I love being an optimist. And I think about Sarah Blakely, who is one of the youngest billionaires self-made and one of the only self-made women billionaires, one of the few. And she said that she learned about failure from her father. Her father taught her that there was no such thing as failure. It was just a result. It was just an outcome. And because she looked at it that way, she could go through the sales process with different stores and sell her products. And if she got rejected, she didn't feel really rejected. I mean, she, I'm sure, had feelings about it, but she just looked at it as, okay, on to the next one. And I think if we can keep that attitude that we just need to keep going, not quit, we need to learn from our mistakes, not make the same ones over and over, but to try and move forward, I think that is a good attitude to have.
Okay, I guess it's good to be optimistic. I certainly agree with Miranda's sentiment. Just get over it. And I think the critical thing is don't get into it if you can't stand the risk. If you feel that your personality is such that you can't get over it, and if you've lost money before and you just bang your head against the wall or you yell and scream, then maybe the markets really aren't for you, and certainly not in a big way. You know, maybe if you want to try it, start with some baby steps, but nothing major. You know, I remember we had on the show here a little while back Terry O'Dean, who's the professor from California, who does all these studies about how people trade. And one of the things he said is he looked at is when people would sell stocks, then buy other ones. I forget the exact number, but something like 2 out of 3 times the stock that they sold went up subsequently, and the one they bought went down. And it goes to your AT&T story. So I think the point is really important, which is A, learn from failures, but B, stick with it. It's okay to be optimistic, because over time, if you're investing, things will probably turn out okay. And if they don't, as Shannon was teaching us, well, okay, just work a little harder and find a new solution. You know, one of the problems is that the people that will often criticize you the most or kind of go after you the most or maybe not work with you so well is the person with whom you really have to get along well, your spouse. Linda, how do you think couples who really do have to handle money together can do it so that they don't kill themselves or kill each other?
I think the first thing is to get on the same page, where they have to talk about what are their goals, what are their expectations, what are they looking to accomplish together. And then from there, realize that men and women often have opposite approaches to certain things and have different things that they're emphasizing. For example, studies have found women tend to be a little bit more safety oriented at times, and men can be looking more for, you know, what is the best performing stock or best performing mutual fund out there. So they're looking for what's something faster growing, which implies more risk. So you've got this yin and yang, which can actually make couples stronger together. But I think that they need to really get on the same page, because what can happen is they can get polarized, and then they can be feeling like, well, you're not like me and you're not understanding what I'm thinking. Instead of getting polarized, they need to really come together on the same page and realize that they're really going to complement each other by working together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds very nice. That sounds sort of like rather optimistic, because the fact is we know that it's difficult to do that. Shannon, when people are in the financial gym and they clearly don't see, you know, eye to eye, and maybe they don't even have the same goals, where should they start?
Yeah, I was going to say, it is nice when you can get two people to agree on similar goals, but it doesn't always happen like that. And I think sometimes you just have to admit, when you're working together as a couple, that you're not going to always see eye to eye. And that's where you have to figure out the compromises and figure out if one person's goal is going to take precedent for a while, then the other person's goal needs to have, you know, respect or something like that. I've got a couple right now. The wife's goal is to move from the state to go somewhere else, and the husband clearly does not have that goal.
Does she want to move with him or on her
own?
Yeah,
she would love for him to come and her two kids to join. And in my mind, I'm like, oh, this is going to be a problem. But then, you know, so what we're doing is we're focusing on other things right now. They actually need to build their wealth more before anything happens. So the husband definitely wants to move from the home they're in. So at least we're finding the common ground, and the goal is to build the wealth so that they can move. And then, honestly, I don't know what we're going to do about compromising with the location. But, you know, sometimes you just have to think outside the box. And I tell clients too, or when I talk to people, if you have a difficulty communicating with your spouse on financial issues, or your significant other, or whoever you're with on financial issues, because a lot of times it's almost like a language barrier. Women are communicating in English and men are communicating in French, and they're not hearing each other. And I always say, if that happens, get a third person, get an advisor, a planner, a money coach, whoever, somebody to come in and kind of help interpret the two, because I think that's also a challenge. I see that with my couple clients. It's, they don't necessarily have different goals or different agendas. They just aren't communicating it well. And then it just ends up turning into a fight. But if you could get somebody who could kind of help you in the middle ground, then I think that's a great solution.
Got it. Miranda, do you think that that's the way to go, is to get kind of an arbitrator?
Yeah, if you are having a hard time seeing eye to eye, it's very important to get that third party in there, somebody who's not as invested in the outcome. This is one of the reasons why counseling actually works so well, like psychological type counseling after my divorce, just because you're talking to somebody who doesn't have like this really vested interest in the outcome. So bringing in somebody from the outside who can look at things with a fresh eye and who doesn't, you know, have a horse in the race, so to speak, can really help you calm down and look at things in a new way.
Yeah, I think that's important. I often sort of joke with people that in my day job as a financial advisor, I spend a lot of time as a marriage counselor, just kind of helping people to talk about money, because I think a lot of times people have unrealistic goals of what they should be doing, what they can be doing, and they just need someone who's not, you know, who doesn't have a particular interest one way or another, just to describe whatever the situation is in other words. You know, there's one thing talking about goals, and there's the other kind of practical matter. Who should do what? How do you divide the work? Are you guys of the mind that you should sort of do it all together, or do you prefer to segment it? Linda, how about you?
Well, I find that people like one thing or another thing. They have a skill set that makes them either, you know, like to be the one paying the bills or like to be the one doing more of budgeting kind of things, or there's different strengths and likes and dislikes, and it's hard to try to get someone who doesn't like to do something to do it. So I think you have to compromise. You have to go with what are the things that people want to do and like to do. And but you also have to bring along the other one who's not interested and make sure that they're up to date. I like Joe's idea of having the weekly meetings. I think that makes a lot of sense to have discussion, if at least if both parties aren't doing the work and one's more on top of the bills or the budget or things like that, then we still need to have communication between the two. So I think, you know, separating tasks by who likes to do it and who wants to do it can be helpful if you can work it out that way.
Got it. And Shannon, do you have some input on this one?
Yeah, I agree with Linda. I think you have to first start with who feels comfortable with what. I think sometimes somebody will assume a role because maybe they have, quote, more time and they're doing it and they're hating it. And then it's not going to get done well, or, you know, they're not going to survive it. I find that no matter who's doing what roles, definitely from a female perspective, they want to feel like they're being partnered with. So even if it's the woman who's doing all the home CFO role, she still wants her significant other to ask questions, to be involved, to have discussions. And I'm a big fan of the money date. Some of my clients get it for financial exercises. They have to have money dates a certain period of time and where they sit and talk about money. And the money date doesn't have to be like spreadsheets and boring. You know, I'm all for having a glass of wine or a cocktail and making it fun, because money shouldn't be all depressing and stuff, and have a conversation around it. But whoever's doing the role, there should be a conversation between the couple.
I like your model. There's a lot of wine involved in your financial
world. Yeah, well, and my podcast is called Martinis and Your Money. You know, it's like whatever gets you through the day, you know. We don't judge here at the gym.
So you start in the morning. Screwdrivers at 9. All right. Yeah, it's funny the way you're describing it. I also think that when people work on it together and there's actually work being done, like having, you know, a budget that's written down or the expenses that are written down. I had a couple, I remember a while ago, that came in. They were doing a financial plan, and the husband was hinting, you know, rather overtly, that his wife was a huge spender. You know, he would work really hard and she would spend a lot. And as we progressed in doing the plan, it turned out that it was totally not the case, that the wife was the world's greatest shopper. Everything was on sale, and she didn't spend a lot, but the husband was the one who was going out for 3 martini lunches and spending huge amounts of money. And when they finally got everything on paper and could see what was going on, then it was no longer a fight based on not having any facts, but B, it was just, then we were able to handle it as a business decision. Okay, you know, where do we need to cut, as opposed to one spouse accusing the other one of, you know, overspending or investing badly. And I think that also goes along with just how you handle the money, that certainly for big investment decisions like asset allocation, it seems to me to make sense for both people to be involved in that decision together, because, you know, as we've pointed out, that is probably one of the most important decisions. But what do you do if one of them doesn't really like managing money or dealing, or just says, you know, I don't know anything about stocks and bonds, you do it. Miranda, how would you deal with that?
One of the things that happened during my marriage when I was in one was that my ex never wanted to deal with any of that. So he just let me do it. I tried to get him interested in it and he was never interested in it. He always just wanted me to handle it. And that was kind of frustrating for me, because I thought, well, you should be involved. It's your money too. We need to make these decisions together. You should understand what's going on. If something should happen to me, you should know what is happening. And he was just never interested in the end. It was just a fight to get him to be interested. And I just slowly stopped bothering trying to get him interested. And I just handled it myself because it was that much easier. After our divorce, then he decided he wanted to sit down, since he had to manage his own money now. We sat down and I took him through everything that I used to do and showed him how to make a budget and showed him how to open up a Betterment account and showed him how to choose index funds for his 403B, you know, went through that with him finally after we divorced. But you can't make somebody do something no matter how hard you try. And I wanted him to be interested in managing the money and I wanted him to take an interest, and he didn't want to, and I couldn't make him. until it, you know, actually really impacted his life. So it's nice that there's like a magical solution to that, but there isn't. The best you can do is offer or, you know, pull it out while your partner's around and just say, oh, hey, I'm going to, you know, check our portfolio right now and see if they want to come over and take a look at it. because trying to force somebody to do something they don't want to do is a huge recipe for disaster.
I think that is very true. Linda, do you think you can, well, I know you said you can't really force people to do things, but what's your take?
Well, I think it's difficult because if people don't want to do something, you can't force them to do it. But I think education is super important. And it sounds like Miranda ended up educating him, and now he probably handles it, I would imagine, pretty well. But it's hard when people aren't interested. And I think that we don't get the education in school. We don't learn these things. And that's why a lot of us are in business, is to teach people some of the things that they didn't learn in school that perhaps will help them get more interested, because we can teach it in a way that's not boring, not dry, and not a bunch of numbers or math or whatever it is that people are afraid of. So,
right, that is critical. All right. Listen, I think as far as keeping things exciting, let's wrap it up for today. We're just about out of time here. Shannon, can you tell us what's going on in the financial gym?
Well, we're just hanging out at the financial gym here in New York City, which is our first physical location at 226 Fifth Avenue, and helping people get and stay financially fit and drinking.
And drinking. And people can just come in, or is it like a...
Yes, they can come in. Yes, it's come in. We have on our website, financialgym.net, our hours. But whenever we're open, we're here.
All right, that sounds super. Mm-hmm. Linda, what's going on being wealthy and smart?
Be Wealthy and Smart, we're talking about how to invest wisely so that people can compound at above average rates and build some wealth. Because I am of the opinion that wealth building is through compounding, and you can do it through investing. Other than some opinions that you have to just save to try and get yourself to wealth, I don't think that's it. I don't think that's going to do it. I think you do have to invest. So we're going to talk more about that.
All right. And Miranda, how about you?
Yeah. So if you head over to adulting.tv, I've finally done my review of OKCupid and my experience dating at OKCupid. So if you want to learn about how somebody offered to pay me to be their dominatrix, you know, head on over. I could have made some money.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I did make some money.
Sadly,
I'm the optimist, Shannon.
Sadly, I'm not quite to the point where I'm willing to...
You're a hustler, just not that much of a hustler.
All right, we'll check that out. And at the Rich is a King blog at richisaking.com, one of the issues that people we sort of touched on recently is what to do with a bad investment. I wrote a whole... What I think is an epic piece called What Should You Do with a Bad Investment at richisaking.com on our blog page. And I think that's it for today. So Miranda, I'm going to ask you to, if you please, because we all do things, even if we don't like to do them sometimes, could you take us out?
Be sure to check us out at moneytreepodcast.com. You can see all of our episodes, our show notes, and a few more resources to help you along in your journey. You can also use our contact form to send us questions. We love answering listener questions. They're some of our favorite episodes. So send us your questions and we'll try to get them on the air and give you our 2 cents for what it's worth, which is usually less than 2 cents. At any rate, check us out on iTunes and Stitcher. Be sure to subscribe, leave us a review on iTunes, and remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.